Good afternoon, everyone. We're about to be joined by Joe Freeman, who will be on our panel today. But I'd like to begin and welcome you all to this discussion about where it all began. How did we get here? There's a tendency, I think, on our part to notice the big events, marking points that differentiate one period from another, the places that can be clearly delineated or defined, and to pay less attention to the transitions, the stuff in the shadows, the gradations that begin to produce differences gradually, slowly, incrementally, that suddenly then amount to something significantly different. So if we ask what year did the free speech movement begin, many people will say 1963, 1964. But our panel here today is going to take us back 7 years to the origins.
37.
Huh?
37.
37?
Yeah.
37 years?
Yeah. I'm going to go back.
We have the
law. Ah, yes, yes. The 7 years from prior to 1963, or 37 years from today. 37? Okay. Ignore him.
Don't allow him to provoke.
Okay. So, so here's the basic problem for all of us. If we ask the question, were we successful? On some levels, yes. If we ask a second question, are we done yet? The answer, I think, is clearly no. So, what are the things that actually make a difference in the periods between high points in political activity? What was it that happened that made a difference and really propelled the free speech movement into existence, that gave it strength before it even confronted its first major challenges? That's our topic for today. So we have, or soon will have, five major speakers. Joe Freeman is on her way. The first is Mike Miller. Mike is really the founder of Slate, and before Slate, a group called TASC, Toward an Active Student Community. Let me ask this question. Raise your hand if you were a member of Slate. Okay, the center panel here is strong in Slate membership. Raise your hand if you have heard of TASC. Okay, a few more people. So what we want to take a look at is, what was it like in the dark days of the 1950s before the free speech movement really gave us a taste of what it feels like to be successful? Mike is going to start us off. He is a community organizer, the founder of Organized Training Center. He is going to take us back to those early years in the 1950s when all of this began.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be part of this panel of old friends and to share our story of the early days of the Berkeley student movement. Too many tales present FSM as some kind of immaculate conception. That is not the case. Slate, the campus political party, was already 6 years old when FSM was founded. Slate was in part inspired by the 1956 Montgomery bus boycott, and certainly later by the student-led civil rights movement in the South. In 1956, Martin Luther King spoke to a group of us at the University YMCA. In 1960, there were large demonstrations against the House Un-American Activities Committee. The Immaculate Conception idea is also applied to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and is also inaccurate there. Unfortunately, the idea of Immaculate Conception is not limited to the mass media, from which we shouldn't expect much more. It is found in our own histories of the period. Slate's founders were in debt to older graduate students who shared experiences and ideas with us. including Nat Huggins, Kerry McWilliams Jr., Fritjof Tygeson, Herb Mills, and Ralph Schaefer. There were off-campus mentors like Cecil Thomas, Pierre Delatre, Hal Norton, Bogdan Denich, and institutions with which some of them were affiliated, like Stiles Hall and the Berkeley Student Cooperatives. There were faculty people who inspired and challenged us with their courses, such as Jacobus Tenbrook's Equality and Free Speech classes, Charles Gulick's Labor History, William Kornhauser's Social Movements, Philip Selznick's Sociology of Organizations, Kenneth Stamp's American History. Finally, there was a small and vibrant left that sponsored speakers who addressed us from flatbed trucks at Sather Gate and in forums at Stiles Hall, and who organized demonstrations and other activities to which they invited a student body which, it must be said, largely ignored them. There were organizations like the Student Civil Liberties Union, Young Democrats, Students to Combat McCarthyism, and others. By and large, they too were ignored. We were, it is accurate to say, the silent generation, but that soon ended. The specific origin of SLATE is in the person of Fritjof Tygeson, who brought the idea of a campus political party to UC. Fritjof was an agitator par excellence. A first effort called Toward an Active Student Community, or TASC, didn't get off the ground, but the idea didn't die. I was already an incumbent representative at large in the student government. When the next election came, I resigned and organized a slate to protest what we called sandbox politics because of the student government's refusal to act on issues of civil rights, economic justice, apartheid in South Africa, compulsory ROTC, abolition of capital punishment, A and H-bomb testing, and others. We organized a lively campaign that addressed these issues as well as immediate student campus concerns. Our SLATES campaign doubled the electorate and won 35% to 45% of the vote. That encouraging result led to the founding convention of SLATE in early 1958. SLATE later became an acronym when the administration, our best organizer, threw us off campus. SLATE now became Student League Accused of Trying to Exist. There are some important things we did that allowed us to break out of our marginal status on the campus and to begin to end the accuracy of the silent generation label. We sought to win the support of majorities on the campus. It was our base. We wed intimate knowledge of student government and the day-to-day concerns of students with expressions of commitment on the great issues of the day. We ran candidates for student government office, vastly increased the electorate, challenged the political hegemony of our ruling class, the fraternity-sorority crowd, and won elections. We were multi-issue in character. We called our program the lowest significant common denominator because we framed it to gain the broadest support. We built a base among independents, commuters, graduate students, the co-ops, university dorms, the campus religious centers, and even in some fraternities and sororities. We were the incubator of numerous single-issue groups and campaigns. SLATE trained people who provided leadership in other efforts, and reciprocally, these single-issue groups serve to bring students into the wider politics of the student movement. It was largely through them that SLATE people organized forays off campus into farm labor, capital punishment, war and peace, civil rights, civil liberties, and other areas. our actions stimulated action by larger social groupings that also had been silenced by the Cold War consensus and remnants of the McCarthy era. We were an ally of newly emerging social movements, union organizing, community organizing, and issue politics. While we were not as successful in this regard as we may have hoped, we made a difference. We looked for opportunities to address issues that would connect us with the efforts of organized labor, the civil rights, and peace movements. Slate's initial nucleus was determined not to be trapped in the debates that fractured the left. We intentionally recruited liberals, independent radicals, and radicals from the variety of organized strands of the left. They were all part of the committees that organized the Slate founding convention. We broke the chilling effect of anti-communist hysteria that characterized the period immediately before us. We made imaginative use of tactics, but didn't fall into the trap of guerrilla theater, which measures its success by whether or not it makes the evening TV news or by how much it disrupts business as usual, whatever the effects of that disruption on public policy, public opinion, or organizational development. We were calculating in our choice of tactics, how we presented ourselves to the public in signs, slogans, and our own dress. While our commitments were moral, we also wanted to be effective. We built a sense of community among us, bonds attested to by the friendships among us today. Slate has many lessons to offer our present situation. A return to those lessons is essential if we are to break out of our present isolation, win majorities, and build organizations that can exercise real people power. There is a deep yearning among Americans to be members of something meaningful, to act on the best of our values, to be co-creators of their destinies rather than consumers of the offerings of distant and unaccountable elites. So, too, is there a deep sense of fairness among a majority of the American people. We learned something about how to tap these sources of energy for a politics that put people first. Contextualized and properly applied to current circumstances, principles that were valid then are valid now. Those of us who believed in a politics of transformation must walk a very narrow bridge between the isolation of moral purity and the co-optation of incrementalism. For most of its life, Slate successfully did that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. If you hold your questions until the end, we'll have an open question period. Our next speaker is Peter Frank. Peter has been a lawyer in the Bay Area for many, many years. He was a former attorney for Mario Savio, and there's a wonderful photograph of him giving legal advice at the police car to Jack Weinberg trapped behind, if you want to take a look at that. Peter was also very involved in the university speaker and politics ban that was created by the university. Now the question becomes, where really did that come from, and how did we get rid of it, even for just a little while? Peter.
Thanks, Ken. I'm going to speak a little less formally than Mike, and hopefully it won't be too disjointed. I'm going to talk about the speaker ban, which was really a meeting ban. During most of its history, it was called Rule 17. We spent a lot of time in the year or two before Slate in trying to get the administration to waive that. I'll come back to that in a minute. The speaker ban, it was a ban on not only speakers, but any political meeting on the campus. It had its roots, this, I may have been wrong on 37, but anyway, it had its roots in about 1937 when there were massive demonstrations, particularly at UCLA, against rearmament and the potential draft. There were more isolationist demonstrations, really, than radical ones that we would think of. But they frightened Robert Gordon Sproul, who was president of the university, and they got some bad attention from the university's point of view, from the press, and from the state legislature. So that the ban was enacted, like I say, in about 1937, and it existed into our period. Around 1956, Clark Kerr, who was the chancellor of this campus at that time, before he was president, and who tried to develop a did develop a relationship between him and us student leaders, which, you know, was co-optive, but it had its points. He asked us to encourage us to persuade Robert Gordon Sproul to liberalize Rule 17. And we proceeded to do that in a behind-the-scenes kind of way. Mike was involved with this. Other people who were involved with Stiles Hall were involved with this. To getting student leaders, even from the sororities and from the more establishment part of the campus, to sign on to the idea that, yes, we should be able to have political meetings on the campus. Side point, you know, it wasn't just Marxists who were speaking to us from the sidewalk. I remember listening to Kefauver, who was then the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who was standing on a trailer on Oxford Street, and the rest of us were sitting on the grass. It was that kind of a complete ban. We got a lot of support quietly from student leaders from the idea of a little bit more politics on the campus. Mike and I had one of our not completely infrequent conflicts about how to go about things. I wanted to do it behind the scenes, quietly, in an elitist way. Mike thought that we should have a public campaign, and that because the consequence of winning should be to educate the campus. I now, and I've thought this for quite a few years now, I think he was right, and I was wrong about that. It did result in some liberalization of Rule 17 and so some political meetings being allowed on campus. I want to say a couple of things about the consequences. I want to say a couple of things about the consequences. When I first came to this campus in 1953, Clark Kerr was making impassioned speeches at us freshmen, sophomores, and students, decrying student apathy and encouraging us to get involved in university affairs and public affairs. As soon as we did, and that's the later period that Mike's been talking about, he came down on us like a ton of bricks. And that was a very important part of the process of a lot of us being radicalized, going from ACLU liberals to some kind of revolutionaries or at least radicals, because as soon as he did that and did the opposite of the rhetoric he'd been giving us, we had to ask, well, why was he doing that and who was really calling the shots, pulling the strings? So student activism, let me just say a couple other things. One of the consequences of the speaker ban was the only place that political organizations like the student chapter of the ACLU, which I was involved in, Students to Combat McCarthyism, which some other people here were involved in, various political groups could meet, was Mike referred to it as the University YMCA. It was called Stiles Hall then. I think it still is called Stiles Hall. The building is still there at the corner of Dana and Bancroft. And Stiles Hall was in many ways So this was one of the good unintended consequences of the speaker ban. The only place we could come for our various meetings was Stiles Hall. So it forced us together, and it helped weld the core of what became Slate, because we knew each other, we'd worked together. Stiles Hall had a free speech policy that went back to its previous executive director, Harry Kingman. I think it says something about – so let me put it this way. The campus was largely but not entirely dead. There was a spark going on at Stiles Hall. Mike and I met when we ran against each other for presidency of the student cabinet to succeed Thelton Henderson, who is this wonderful federal judge, been this wonderful federal judge for many years controlling the prisons, who was fired from his job as a civil rights lawyer in the Justice Department before he was appointed to the bench for lending Martin Luther King his car one day. Stiles Hall brought the people who were political into that one arena. So I see a little different from what Ken posed, a steady arc going up and down at points of student activism. The campuses were very active in the pre-war period. They were very active in the immediate post-World War II period when the veterans came and were at Berkeley under the Bill of Rights. There's a lot of activism. When we came, they had graduated. The Red Scare period of McCarthyism had started, and the campus was much more quiet. But there was steadily growing activism. Let me see if I missed anything here. So, as I say, one consequence of the policy was to forge a group of student leaders who were able to, as the McCarthy cloud was lifting, really change the campus, as Mike described. I'll end with a story that I have to tell, particularly in these hallowed halls. The free speech movement was 1964. 1963, I was a graduate student in the law program here at Bolt, and my subject was the constitutional rights of college students. My faculty advisor told me that it was an unimportant topic. And this was Ira Michael Heyman, who, for his perspicacity, was subsequently awarded with the deanship of this place. It was a good example, and I think the FSM found it, we found it at different places, that of the fact that most faculty were really out of touch with what was happening on the campuses. Thanks.
A major shift took place in 1960, and one of the trigger points that catapulted many of us into political activity was the arrival of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, subpoenaing a student, Douglas Wachter, with a series of demonstrations that took place in San Francisco and galvanized the student community. Our next speaker is Herb Mills. Herb is former secretary treasurer of ILWU Local 10, also business agent for Local 10. His topic is going to be confronting persecution, the 1960 anti-HUAC demonstrations. Herb.
Thank you, Kenny. My first Slate meeting I went to went there because I had learned that the House Un-American Activities Committee was scheduled to come to San Francisco. And I had transferred, it's a long story, but I had transferred after 6 years at Ann Arbor to Berkeley. And the last thing I did in Ann Arbor was a House Un-American, State Un-American Activities Committee meeting in Lansing. We picketed, a few of us from Ann Arbor. So I thought, well, I might as well start there. I was interested certainly in that. And as a result, I guess out of that was I ended up being the picket captain of what became the City Hall Revolt or City Hall Riot or whatever various names were given to it. I think that the thing maybe to stress here is that in working on that, forming that, what would become the picket line, Slate had decided to make this another non-Slate organization event by having it officially an event of the student wing of the ACLU. And that was because Slate, we knew, had become sufficiently controversial that we didn't want the price of being on the picket line that you'd be on a Slate picket line. We wanted it something else. And that was common with us by that time. And there we did that in civil rights. We did that in farm worker. We did that on capital punishment. As Kenny and a number of people have already mentioned, we looked for other people to be the front, at least the public leaders. So that's what we did in this case. And I guess you could say it worked. In any event, just so you know, the reason that that ruckus began is that students had lined up outside the doors of the meeting, the room where the House would hold its hearings, had lined up very early in the morning, hoping to get in for a seat. And about the time that the committee was ready to start, a rather lengthy line of elderly citizens with invitations from the committee got to the front door, and they were the ones that were let in. Well, this caused, you know, a goddamn row. And pretty soon there started being some singing outside that door and this, that, and the other thing going on. And I remember the guy that was leading the choir, he made quite a ruckus. And presently the police came along and wanted to shut the group up, and that didn't work too well. And pretty soon the fire hoses got broke out, and pretty soon they're washing people down the stairs. And you get the picture on the front page of the Chronicle the next day of kids being washed down the steps of the city hall and so on. But anyway, that's about all I got to say on that score of that particular demonstration. And
did you want to mention anything about the Longshore?
Well, I became in 19. I left campus in 1963. Having been 7 years here, I ended up with a PhD here. But that's another story. I left because I had a chance to become a longshoreman. That's ILWU Local 10 in the Bay Area, and ended up having the opportunity to be the secretary treasurer and the business agent any number of years. And every now and then we got something done. And I was the officer involved in 1978 when we refused to load military cargo to Pinochet, and also the officer involved when we refused to load military cargo to the Junta of El Salvador. And, well, you can thank the local for that. And it happened that same week we got involved in a row with Kim Dae-jung had been arrested and tried for treason during the Reagan campaign in South Korea. And we were concerned about him, as we were similar figures around the world. Mandela is an honorary member of Local 10, as was Martin Luther King. Anyway, we ended up sending a wire to the military government of the Republic of South Korea and said that were he to be hung as he had been sentenced to be, we would, with our allies around the Pacific Basin, trade union allies around, take appropriate action. Well, I was working with a group of Korean students from both Berkeley and from, not working with them, but sitting in with them, from Berkeley and Stanford. They were mostly physicists and chemists, but they were part of the Save Kim Dae-jung Committee, International Committee. And we sent a wire where we threatened this government with appropriate action, were he to be hung. And then I met with the student to tell him what the appropriate action would be. We wouldn't load a goddamn thing, either load it or discharge it from South Korea, period. And neither would our allies around the Pacific. Well, as you probably know, he wasn't hung. On the contrary, he was eventually elected the first president of South Korea. Well, anyway, so I went from a pretty exciting life on campus to a very exciting life and challenging, interesting life on the waterfront.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Joe Freeman. Joe is the, in addition to being a next-door neighbor of mine growing up in the San Fernando Valley, she has been an activist for all of this period of time, has written a book at Berkeley in the 1960s, which is really a brilliant little piece of analysis of what happened, and also a paper called The Tyranny of Structurelessness that Mike talked about the other night. Her topic is going to be confronting racism at home, the 1963-64 Bay Area Civil Rights Movement. Joe. Okay.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Good. I want
Joe,
face
no.
Joe,
you
got
to
talk into the mic because he's recording.
Oh, I hate being stationary. I like to pace. Okay. Didn't see you over there. I'm hiding behind you.
FSM. Wrong one. This one's.
During the FSM, right. I often heard it said that we'd gone off to Mississippi in the summer and come back having learned how to revolt. Well, they got that one wrong, too. The FSM was not the child of Freedom Summer. It was the child of the Bay Area Civil Rights Movement, which had consumed the Bay Area beginning in the fall of 1963 and going through the spring of 1964. Now, I must say that wasn't our first confrontation with racism at home. There were many over a period of years, but the one in which I was personally active in happened in the spring of 1963 when the Berkeley City Council voted to have a fair housing ordinance. And a group of citizens immediately passed a petition and got a referendum on the ballot to withdraw the Fair Housing Ordinance. So we all mobilized around that old bugaboo of electoral politics to defeat the referendum, and we lost. The citizens of Berkeley have voted to abolish fair housing. In September of 1963, there was a little fraternity event. The JCs traditionally sponsored a homecoming contest with queen candidates from around the country, and the University Men's Society picked the men to be their escorts. Now, I should tell you, the number of African Americans in this campus in 1963 was minuscule. But one of them was picked to be an escort, and the JCs decided to eliminate him out of concern for the mental and physical well-being of the girls. Of course, they didn't ask the girls. Slate picketed the JCs, and the university withdrew its support. So that ended that little event. That was the beginning of the civil rights movement, but it was certainly not the end. There were two organizations that were active in promoting civil rights. One was CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. The other was something called the Ad Hoc Committee to End Discrimination, which was formed that fall. It had three co-chairs, one of whom, Mike Meyerson, was a former chair of Slate. Another of whom, Roy Ballard, I don't quite know where he came from. The third, Tracy Sims, was an 18-year-old African-American girl who had graduated from Berkeley High School and dropped out of SF State in order to be active in civil rights. She became the spokesperson for the ad hoc committee and did a marvelous job. The first demonstration was at Mel's Drive-In because the kids had told the organizers that they could buy food at Mel's, but they couldn't be hired there. So the ad hoc committee first sponsored a sit-in. People would go in, and they would stand in line and not order any food. And when that didn't work, they literally sat in and got arrested. The owner of Mel's happened to be running for mayor that year. He lost. The next demonstration was at Lucky Supermarket. Remember all Lucky Supermarket? Well, that's where we did the shopping. People would go in and load up their baskets and get to the checkout counter and then discover, gee, I must have left my wallet at home. We settled that one too. Things were quiet for a few weeks, and then the ad hoc committee decided to go after the hotels. Now, being a waiter or a waitress was a very traditional job for an African American in the South. But the San Francisco hotels hired virtually none for that position. They only hired them to be maids and cleaners. We picked the Sheraton Palace as the primary target. The Sheraton, in turn, got a court injunction limiting the pickets to 9 people at a time. So one day, after flyering the entire campus, including from Bancroft and Telegraph, we told everyone to come to the Sheraton for a little demonstration. 2,000 people showed up. We marched out front. We marched around the side. And at some point, we walked in the door, marched to the main lobby, took a left turn, and then marched out the other entrance. And then after a while, a few people started sitting down. There were plenty of chairs in that lobby. And more set in, and more, and more. And the hotel went off and got another court injunction, and they said we'd all be arrested. And that's the point at which we sat down. Now, in those days, demonstrations were governed as much by a labor ethos as by a civil rights ethos. So we didn't just sit down. We linked arms and completely blocked the entire lobby. 167 of us were arrested that night. This was followed by a series of demonstrations against Otto Rowe. You all remember Otto Rowe? Van Ness Avenue? Well, there was two sets on two different days in which we all sat in at the Otto Rowe agencies. And another few hundred people were arrested. One of my arrests was the Sheraton Palace, and another of my arrests was the Cadillac agency. Maybe the closest I've ever come to sitting in a Cadillac. Well, after that, all of the employers were very willing to settle. And I must say, Mayor Shelley and the labor unions were very important at forcing the various employers to come to the bargaining table. Don't have enough time to go into those details. So the demonstration sort of ended very slowly after a period of time. They were replaced by the trials. Something like 500 people had been arrested in these demonstrations. Now, I needn't tell you that 500 trials can wreak havoc with the court system. They decided to try us in groups of about 10 to 12. Some were more larger, some were smaller. They separated out the women and tried them separately, for the most part, not entirely. There was a mixture in the attitudes of the judges, and there was a vast mixture in the outcomes of the trials. There were quite a few hung juries, but the prosecution was quite willing to try people a second and third time. Overall, roughly half of us were acquitted and roughly half of us were convicted. I got one of each. Then came the sentences. Now, this was in the day in which they believed that if they punished us harshly, we'd stop. You all know that did not happen. My one conviction, my first conviction, a conviction for misdemeanor trespassing, I got 15 days. Tracy Sims, our spokeswoman, got 90 days. Dr. Burbridge, a professor of pharmacology at the University of San Francisco Medical School, who was head of the NAACP, got 9 months. Now, the reason these demonstrations are important is because it was the primary teaching mechanism for the students at both Berkeley and San Francisco State, both of which had major sit-ins within a year or so. Indeed, so important were these demonstrations that I'm willing to say that had there been no Bay Area civil rights movement, there would have been no free speech movement. Now, there would have been some student protest, but the free speech movement translated from being students protesting into a social movement when Jack Weinberg was arrested and several thousand students spontaneously sat down around the police car. They learned how to do that from the sit-ins of 1963-64. Which is why I say if there'd been no Bay Area civil rights movement, there would have been no free speech movement. It's that history, that sequence of events, that makes us understand how important it is to keep organizing all the time.
Thank you, Joe. The next period is the period of the transition into the free speech movement itself and the period of the end of SLATE. Our next speaker is Wendell Bruner, who is the director of the Department of Health for Contra Costa County. Wendell's topic is the end of SLATE, its legacy, and its meaning.
So I was picked to be here because I was the last chairperson of SLATE, so they put me over here on this side between one of the first chairpeople of SLATE. But what it did point out is that SLATE really had two generations. There was the first generation, which is indicated by, you know, Peter Frank and Mike Miller and Herb Mills, and they've talked about that. And then there was a hiatus. And the academic year of 62-63, SLATE was pretty close to moribund. I remember I came to my first SLATE meeting in the fall of 1962. I had just turned 17. I was starting as a freshman in Berkeley. My sister was 5 years older, had been in SLATE, and so I knew something about it. I saw a sign. I was living at home in El Cerrito. I got on my motor scooter. I tootled over to Stiles Hall to go to my first SLATE meeting. And there was a small group of people, sort of without much energy, all kind of talking to each other, debating. Actually, it was an issue on tobacco and cigarette smoking, which I thought was kind of strange for Slate. But I was very interested, I guess, that really didn't know I was going to become a public health director. And nobody came up to me. Nobody said, hi, who are you? What brings you here? You know, what are you interested in? Utterly ignored until the time came to vote on this resolution, and I raised my hand, voted in for me. Apparently it was split and it was tight and it was very important for this group of people. So they all turned around and looked at me and said, are you a member of SLATE? You know, so I said, no. And, you know, well, they didn't come and try to sign me up. And they said, well, you can't vote. And then they turned around. So that was my last SLATE meeting for quite a while. until I think probably in the spring when Slate was going to get together, and there was a story in probably even the Chronicle, but certainly in the Daily Cal, that Slate was going to consider dissolving. And everybody came out of the woodwork to come, and I came to that meeting and said, you know, Slate shouldn't dissolve and so on, and we voted to sort of reestablish ourselves. Robin Room stepped up to become the chair. Robin Room had seen this young kid talk up about how enthusiastic we got to do something for Slate, and he put me on the steering committee, made me administrative officer, which turned out meant I worked the mimeograph machine and signed up for the classes and so the rooms and so on. But had that sort of organizing principle. The strengths then of Slate as it redeveloped were the original strengths, which was Slate was built around some common fundamental values that had broad appeal. The fundamental values of fairness, of justice, economic justice, kinds of fundamental values that liberal students and radical students could all come together around. It made a big deal about being non-sectarian in terms of all the different sectarian, radical, and other groups. So we were not going to be that. We were going to focus around this. But it was an important mix of liberals and people who were radical. And I think we in Slate sort of instinctively understood, although we wouldn't formulate it in this way, that these fundamental liberal issues of fairness and justice were really powerful wedges that could open up people's thinking about things and get them to think in a much more radical way. And it's no accident, then, that the FSM was actually organized out of Slate. So Art Goldberg and Sandra Fuchs, they were the chair people. I can't remember which was chair when, but they were running Slate. And the FSM was organized then out of their house, the Slate house, where I happened to be living at the time and trying to get through school and so on, was actually organized out of Slate, because Slate was the organization that could articulate those fundamental sort of liberal values of free speech and bring everybody together, but also had a leadership that understood that free speech can be also fundamentally radical, that the purpose for which free speech was going to be used is, as was just pointed out, was to promote civil rights, to advance economic justice, to support peace, to oppose war, that these were fundamentally very radical issues, and that the common support around free speech gave them a lot of power. And I think because the free speech was potentially so radical, and that's what the free speech movement was about in many ways, was the reason that it was opposed so vigorously by our administrative leadership, who were actually great liberals. They really were. They considered themselves liberals. They were liberals. And yet they were opposed to this liberal value of free speech because they understood really the radical potentials of it. So after the FSM, things developed. I think the war was very, very intense, and it really split off liberals from radicals. The liberals were seen as Cold War liberals, people who were supporting the war. Kids like me who had 1A, would have been classed 1A and passed my pre-induction physical at that time, it's like I was not interested in the liberal values of supporting the Cold War. We were moving towards a much more sort of radical, sort of urgent and desperate approach. And so the organizations became much more radical, and the radicals moved off into the more radical organizations. And what was left of Slate, really, was the most conservative part of the liberals. That is, the people who were running for ASUC and sort of saw Slate as a stepping stone to their sort of ASUC political aspirations, which you can imagine were pretty pitiful if that's your political aspiration. Fundamentally, you want to be the ASUC. So that was kind of the way Slate was going. I, at that point, was the chairperson of Slate, and we could all see that that was happening. So even though Kenny Rogers had not yet pointed it out to us, you have to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. So I and Art and Sander, and we all called everybody we knew and said, look, Slate's been a great organization. It has a wonderful and important history and a vital legacy. Let's all get together for one last meeting and give it a decent burial. So that's what we did. We called it together and abolished the organization, much to the dismay and despair and confusion of these sort of ASUC wannabes who had pretty much taken over the organization. We just dissolved it out from under them. So I think some of the important things, at least for me to learn from Slade and what I've learned from my work is, number one, these fundamental sort of American values of fairness and community and family and justice, these are very, very powerful values, and they resonate to a lot of people. We can't just talk to ourselves if we really want to move. We have to talk to the people who are in the middle. If we're only talking to people who are agreeing with us, we're just wasting our time and our breath. And we have to learn how to talk to people who don't agree with us, how to take those fundamental values that resonate with them, use them as wedges to open up their minds and to move things forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Wendell. So what we'd now like to do is to open this conversation up to you. Wow, lots of hands. So Robin has the microphone. Robin, I'm going to just let you pick
Run around.
People.
Yeah. Okay.
We'd like to ask people to hold their comments so that it to within some kind of 1 to 2 minute framework.
Okay.
Paula.
I just wanted to say, Wendell, I went to my first Slate meeting a few months after my 17th birthday also. Pretty fresh-faced. Mike Schwartz brought me in. Where I just want to ask, the Slate supplement to the general catalog,
yeah,
where does that fit ideologically and otherwise?
Great. Joe?
Okay, as one of the people who was working on it. Oh, you want more questions first?
Use the mic.
No, I really... Okay. Slate had always had an interest in educational reform from the very beginning. We didn't talk about it here because there was just not enough time to do everything. But the Slate supplement was the culmination of that interest in educational reform. We decided if we couldn't change the system, we'd at least educate people. So we... It was actually primarily run by Phil Ruse. I mean, it was a Slate product, but he was the man in charge. He recruited a bunch of people as editors, and we in turn recruited people to as informants, collate. Okay. As informants on the courses they took, and at some point, and I don't know if it was the second one or the third, we moved to passing out a questionnaire. Now, this was not a random sample. We make no claim for that. But essentially, we published what was, for all practical purpose, reviews of courses. And these reviews of courses definitely had reverberations. And in fact, one of the reasons that Vice Chancellor Alex Sheriffs had the deans write that letter kicking us off of Bancroft and Telegraph was because the Slate supplement poorly reviewed the one course he still taught.
Yeah, Mike, I have really two questions. The first one is, after...
Introduce themselves just a little bit, just say...
Oh, my name is Marty Hittleman. I was in Slate from 58 to 60. Actually, in high school, I came up to the founding meeting of Slate, and my brother was also in it. But my question, and my uncle and my grandfather were both called before HUAC. So I was interested in the HUAC demonstration, of course. And the first question I have is that after the demonstration, the committee put out Operation Abolition. And it was shown all over the country. And I've talked to a lot of people that saw it and said, I'm coming to Berkeley. Okay, so I wonder if anyone has done a study of how many people that were arrested that from out of state actually came here because that said, I want to be part of that. The second question is that Mike Meyerson, who I had known in high school, and I were a couple of the people that got into the hearing with white cards into the first day of the hearing. Yeah. And I'm wondering if anyone knows how I got those cards. How it was.
In December, you can ask.
What?
Yeah. He'll be out here in December. You can ask.
Great. Thank you.
Came here because of Operation Abolition. Well, no, let's just take how many came. Okay. Okay, we got one. Okay, and it went two.
Well, my name is Art Goldberg. I was very active just before and during the free speech movement. I want to say a couple things. First, the first things that kicked off the things that led to the free speech movement was very small demonstrations that Slate organized of about 100 people. Then it became a couple hundred people. Then a few of us were kicked out of school, and that allowed us to build a movement. Then we were kicked out a second time and build a bigger movement. So Slate was really instrumental in the whole process of starting the free speech movement. And then it obviously grew beyond that into a major thing, and that's why we're here. But I want to make a separate comment. It's a little depressing to me. At the thing last night, which was great, that wasn't depressing. That was very good. It was exciting to see everyone, and there was a lot of enthusiasm. Meaning the
Slate reunion dinner.
No. Not the Slate reunion.
The FSM thing.
That was good, too. But the general social thing. There's two things I want to say. First, I don't understand, and maybe I'm totally out of touch. One of my kids, all four of my kids are here. My daughter sitting next to me, who is, and they're activists, I'm happy to say, in Los Angeles. Why didn't people bring their children to see this? This was such an important... Oh, good, another one. That's good. No, but there was almost no children or young, you know, what I consider young people, although you aren't... So, but still, that's right. And it's unbelievable to me why people... I know it's a little off topic, but it is on topic in a way. Why people wouldn't want to bring their children... I also brought my... six of my seven grandchildren, because let's face it, we're not going to have a 100th anniversary, you know. We're not going to make another, unless there's some miracle medical thing. Yeah, that I'm going on to that next. Okay, so that is weird to me, why you wouldn't want to share such a great part of your life and enthusiastic about it. Secondly, and people can respond, almost nothing on campus about it. And that does, and there are a lot of political people on this campus, because I've run into many of them during the last day and a half I've been here, who would have said, we would have come. I don't understand. Look at this room. We're all Alta Cockers, translated older people, very older people. And I that was very depressing to me. We brought a group of students from Santa Cruz, Latino students, who we've been meeting with, my wife, because at Marshall High School in L.A. has this great program getting undocumented and lower-income people. And so they're in all the UC campuses, and they wanted to come, so we met with them today. So those are just two observations, and I'll stop, and I'm interested to get a response to that.
Okay, let's find out if anybody on the panel has any responses to that. Well, okay, Robin, you want to?
Answer your question. I'm on the East Coast, and my kids are 40
hold on just a
and, have, and they have kids and all that, but they're very interested. But the question I have has to do with the impetus of the free speech movement, and I haven't heard the role of like Mayor Alioti and William Nolan, the Oakland Tribune, and all the political forces that were at play that sort of accelerated a mass movement. But I mean, I remember I was involved in an organization with Cesar Chavez to raise money for him, and I was pretty pissed off that suddenly we weren't able to do that. And there were a lot of organizations that were involved in politics, and Slate was sort of one of the players. But the fact that they're going to shut that down was absolutely outrageous. And I think it turned into a mass movement very quickly, and I'm not even so sure how that all happened. Perhaps, you know, the small demonstrations, you needed to have things to kind of, like if you build a fire, you have to put kindling in. But in my mind, it was because of the political interference on the outside that sort of galvanized not only the students, but the graduate students, and I would say some of the faculty. When it finally came down to vote, they supported the free speech movement. I was really surprised that it had that kind of support.
Mike, here.
I want to say something about that several comments have triggered. Those of you who were around then will recall that the Mel sit-ins were opposed by liberals and labor in San Francisco, who believed deeply that those sit-ins were going to elect Harold Dobbs as mayor of San Francisco against the kind of labor liberal Jack Shelley. The balance of direct action and what I would call mass organization is a very, very difficult one. And at some point, I think, the student movement lost touch with the idea of keeping in touch with mass base. Mel's drive-in clearly was not an example of that. If anything, it might have helped Shelley get elected. But that it is something that ought to be considered, was considered to be a sellout. And I think that happened in the 64-66 period.
Any other comments, Joe? Yeah,
just one thing. Max Hayrek wrote his dissertation on the free speech movement, and he did a lot of interviewing. And among other things he addressed was how did it get started. When I wrote my book many, many years later, I read a lot of oral histories looking for the answer to that question. It was not, frankly, a result of political interference. I'll leave you to read the books or talk to me afterwards for the story because it's too long. But it really wasn't, which isn't to say there weren't a lot of people angry at those demonstrations. There were. But it was not a direct result of anyone calling – of Nolan calling Kerr, which is the popular myth that went around, and saying, stop those kids from picketing my newspaper. None of that happened. The real political interference came from the legislature. The Berkeley assemblyman at that time was a Goldwater conservative. After the demonstrations in the spring, the Bay Area demonstrations, he actually said that anyone who was arrested for a second time, any student, excuse me, who was arrested for a second time should be automatically expelled. There was a lot of attempts at legislative interference, but the immediate precipitants of the FSM were not due to political interference.
Thank you. Robin, who's next?
Yeah, Dave Richardson. I was in Student Civil Liberties Union, YPSL, Independent Socialist. And I'm thinking back to the demonstrations at City Hall. And what I remember about that, I was a junior in high school when that happened. And in the summer of whatever year that was, 1960, we listened to an LP recording made by KPFA, which talked about those events. And I've always thought that record got me and people like me to come to Berkeley in the subsequent years and subsequent years. It's kind of like the gentleman here with Operation Abolition, but, you know, kind of on the opposite side. And I'm wondering if anyone else ever heard that record. I'm not sure of the title.
It was... The sounds of protest, and it was recorded in part through a number of Slate members. Peter, did you want to comment?
Yeah, actually, just going back one step to build on something Mike said. What Slate was very much about was building and organizing in a sort of solid way where the movement may have gotten a little off track subsequently, was in focusing on mobilizing rather than organizing. And honestly, I think that is one of the weaknesses of the FSM.
Thank you. Your comment.
Apparently this isn't on, I guess. But oh, it is on. Oh, okay. My name is Kay Kennedy, and I wanted to respond to Art. Actually, my son is 40, and he desperately wanted to come, but he's up in the Yukon working, and he couldn't come. And I live in Canada and on Vancouver Island, so it's a little distance, not terribly easy to get here. And everybody I talk to, because I've been talking about nothing much else for the last 2 weeks about coming, and, you know, it doesn't matter what their age, we're all these young people. Oh, I wish I could come. You know, I wish I was part of it. I was born too late, you know, and they were all, I would have filled this room, I think.
Thank you.
My name is Alt Gary. I came to Cal in 1960, and I dropped out to work in the South. I went to teach in Prince Edward County. They closed the schools rather than integrate. The African Americans did not want me to teach, and they didn't want the other young white woman who came from Chicago, I believe, and she was killed by white people, Viola Liuzzo. I came back to Berkeley, and I set up a card table in Sproul to protest the war. I was asked to take away my card table. I never got arrested, but there were people from the South. We had been active in the South before 1963.
This person, Mike.
Yeah, I want to go back to, this is a kind of funny switch of Peter and my argument about insiders versus outsider. Peter earlier said that I wanted a public campaign to change Rule 17. Bob Moses, as you know, was the SNCC director of the Mississippi Summer Project. And when he talks about our success, SNCC's success in Mississippi, he pays tribute to the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which was not in any way, shape, or form the result of mass action. That Civil Rights Act had a little provision that said the Justice Department could intervene and file suits where civil rights workers were arrested for voting rights activity. And Bob says he calls it the crawl space that made possible SNCC's work in the South. So sometimes we contrast these things as if they are opposite. And I'm not, sometimes that's not quite helpful, I think.
Thank you, Mike. Robin?
Yeah.
Yes. Mike Kogan.
I'm Mike Kogan. I was very active in Slate, 62, 63, 64, till the end. And Peter Frank, it's good to see you. It's only been about 50 years, and wanted to thank you for representing Slate in its fight against the administration for being able to show films on campus to raise money for outside activities. One thing that nobody ever mentions, and it's not even mentioned in his book, is that Mario Savio used to come to a lot of Slate meetings. And it was painful because he would always raise his hand and you would think he really had something important to say. And he did. And he tried. But he couldn't do it. And it was just such an amazing thing to see how he changed and what he did. The other thing I think Wendell, what he mentioned was really excellent, is that Slate, for me, provided friendships. Lifetime friendships. I met people in Slate. I met Paula, Jackie Goldberg, Art Goldberg, Sandor Fuchs, Tom Meyer, Wendell, others. Joe Hacker, who I'm sorry couldn't have been here because he would have loved it. Lifetime friendships. And it wasn't just a political organization, which it was. And I got arrested, and Joe Freeman, excellent, at Sheraton Palace, and I served 30 days and got arrested at the Free Speech Movement. But through all of this and the power that I felt during the time that I was involved in politics here, lifetime friendships were really important. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Victor.
Thank you.
My name is Victor Garland. Many ask why did it happen at Berkeley, not at City College of New York or Columbia or Madison or Ann Arbor or UCLA or other places where historically student movements have been very significant? Why did it happen at Berkeley? One of the things that made it happen at Berkeley, I think, and something that hasn't been yet mentioned here, is the loyalty oath, a battle that occurred here in 1949-1950. When I came to Berkeley in 1952, the fallout from the loyalty oath fight was quite pronounced. There were many departments in which faculty members did not speak to each other because of the roles that they had played or were perceived to have played in the loyalty oath fight. There were many young graduate students who had been teaching assistants, who had refused to sign the Regents Loyalty Oath, who were still on campus getting their degrees, many of them in the final throes of a PhD. Those students, those graduate students, were very significant to my generation, the generation that began, let's say, when I came here in 1952. And there were many faculty members on the campus who were veterans of that battle. And they were still here and functioning. I had the experience, for example, when I was the education director at Oxford Hall in the student co-op. And my job was to bring speakers to Oxford Hall to bring a richer experience to the students there. And someone suggested Howard Byrne in the biology department. And I approached him and I said, would you speak on the social significance of science, which in 1952 was kind of a radical topic. And Howard Byrne was an untenured assistant professor, and he said, I need to discuss this with my wife. That will give you an that gives you an example of the atmosphere here in 1952. In order to speak at the student co-op on the subject, the social significance of science, a junior faculty member needed to consult his wife because it was a question of career. The next day, Howard called me and said he would do it, and he came, and there was a large audience. What's significant about that is not so much what he did in 1952, but that in 1964, he was by then a full professor and a world-renowned scholar. He was one of the committee of 200, the faculty that provided the support for the FSM and whose resolution at the Academic Senate on December 8th, supporting the students' right to organize without respect to content and time, place, and manner being the only criteria of legitimacy. The Committee of 200 was made up in part by veterans of the loyalty oath fight, and even those who weren't here during the loyalty oath fight knew about the loyalty oath. They were familiar with it. So the Berkeley campus had a special atmosphere, something that my friend Seth Rosenfeld, who's sitting in the back over there, has written so gracefully about the concern that the FBI and others had about the Berkeley campus, the reason being that it had a long history of political activism, which the FSM was able to use. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for everyone. My name is Dennis Sheldrick. I was an arrestee in 1964. Dennis Sheldrick. I was here in 1964, arrestee, freshman on campus. First, in response to Art, the reason I didn't bring my children, I never saw any notation about child care being provided. So, just kidding. Anyhow. Yeah, grandchildren, right? Even they're past that. But anyhow, That's a good point, Art. You're right. We should have brought more kids with us. I traveled from Oregon, but I just wanted to say, in relation to what brought people here who weren't here during those years that you've discussed and the beginning of Slate and the Otto Rose sit-ins and everything, I read a book, paperback book in 1962 called Student Revolt, I believe, by David. And I read that book, and I was already involved in things in the New York area, and I thought this would be the place to go, and it was. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I think one more comment, and then two more comments, and then I'm going to ask the panelists to make some concluding remarks.
Just I'll do more of a question. Could you comment on the role of social movements, you know, such as counterculture in San Francisco, the beatniks, the hippies? But the beatniks were in San Francisco in the 50s. Whether or not that provided a sort of catalyst and environment for a mass movement to develop on a campus. I mean, there were a lot of cultural changes that were taking place when I came to Cal in 63, for example, in drugs. I mean, grass was starting to spread. And pretty soon, the more traditional political activities were somewhat supplanted with lifestyle and social issues, and they became kind of commingled. So I thought you might have some comments regarding that.
Comments?
We'll leave that for the concluding.
We can do it.
Okay, so some of the panelists would like to touch on it at conclusion. Did you want to comment, Judy?
Say something just on that.
Would you pass her the microphone just for a second?
Well, I graduated.
Introduce yourself, Judy.
What? Oh, I'm Judy Bertelson. I was a member of Slate, and I graduated in 61 and moved to San Francisco. And a guy from my high school, who was an undergraduate at Berkeley at the time, came over for dinner one night, and he made the following observations, just his observation. It was interesting to me. He was not particularly political. I was very surprised to hear him say that had it gone on for another week or so, he would have gotten arrested because he was sufficiently moved by what had been going on. But we were talking about all this, and he said to me the following. He said, when you were at Berkeley, there were the politicos who were very parliamentary, and we all were, and we, you know, were all busy making resolutions and doing this and that. And we all knew Robert's rules and all that. And then there were the arty types, and they were all expressive and doing drugs and all that kind of stuff. And he said, when with our movement, the two combined, and you had expressive politics. And I don't think it's a joke. I think he has a good point. It's not, you know, it's oversimplified. That doesn't explain everything, but there was a difference. You get it. I won't belabor it.
Some of the questions that have come up reminded me of a question that I've always had. I'm Becky O'Malley. I live in Berkeley now. My interest in the activities, now I should say that I predate the free speech movement. I had gone to Ann Arbor by 1961. But while I was here, the thing that got me involved is the number of people I knew whose families had been abused in the McCarthy period. And my next door neighbor was the daughter of a Petaluma chicken farmer. My freshman roommate at another school had both a father and a brother who'd lost their academic jobs because of the McCarthyist period. And I think that had a lot to do with it. I think it started with the loyalty oath, and there was the whole of the 50s. There were people being kicked around from pillar to post, and I think that made a strong influence. It had a strong influence on me because I had come from a very normal liberal democratic family background, and I had no idea that this sort of thing went on. So it was shocking to me, and I think a lot of people who were participating in the activities that Slate was organizing were the same. And I would say that I was not a leader in anything. I showed up when I was told to show up. It was one of the masses. And I think that had to do with a lot of the other women. Now, maybe Joe has something to say about that. But it was not a good opportunity for women to show any kind of leadership, which we worked through in the next decade. But at that point, it was not an easy thing. And I think the question that Art had about where are our kids, my kids are out doing stuff. I don't know whether other people's kids are, but they're all way too busy to fool around with all these old things. But they do have the right values, and I think it's the intergenerational thing. The people who were the parents of my friends and the influence that we had on our children and even our grandchildren that makes a lot of difference.
Thank you very much. Let's just see a show of hands. How many of you had family members who were some way or another victims of McCarthyism? Okay, so a pretty significant number. Thank you. So let's start with, did you want to comment first on her, or should we just go around the panel and you want to save it for concluding remarks?
I'll save it for concluding remarks.
Okay, so let's start with Mike again. Would you like to make some final comments?
Yes, I want to address two points that have been made in various ways. First is direct action / mass mobilization contrasted to deep organizing. I think if the climate change, anti-Middle East intervention, whatever issue we are concerned about, the people who are galvanizing around those issues do not address this question of base, constituency, talking to the middle, building rooted movements that go deep into constituencies, we will continue to be marginalized. Secondly, this multi-generational concern, I think, is a really serious and deep concern. We have not done too well. I mean, I have three stepkids, one of whom I raised from 5 years of age, the others 12 and 15. Passing on our politics to them is not something I think we have done very well. It's the exception among people I know, not the rule. Why that is, why we have not been able to create the institutions that create a counterculture in which kids can grow up feeling that they're part of something of deep meaning and find the ways to express that are appropriate for their time is something that I'm concerned about. I don't have any great answers to.
Okay. A couple minutes each. Peter's next.
Well, I think our basic point is that student activism is an arc of history, and it goes up and down at points. FSM was an up point, but it's very important to understand that it didn't spring full-blown from Mario Savio's head immaculately. I just wanted to speak briefly to what Becky O'Malley raised. We were a product of our times, so us men in Slate, we're not the most enlightened about certain issues. In the 1984, the biggest reunion we've had of Slate was in 1984. There's 150 or 200 people. And halfway through that reunion, the women revolted and raised the issue of how we'd been treating them and what had become, it was in Donnell, 155, what had become a reunion session became a general assembly. And I won't say everything was dealt with, but some real healing about and education about that issue took place in that reunion.
Very good. Thank you, Peter. Herb.
I'm going to pass.
Joe.
Okay. I'm going to respond to the question, or not the question, the statement someone. Okay, I'm going to respond to the statement someone made earlier when they said their children or grandchildren said, "Gee, I wish I'd been around then." The important work is not the big demonstrations or the marches. It's what led up to those demonstrations and marches. It's the organizing, the consciousness raising, the day-to-day nitty-gritty that Slate did and other organizations did before the FSM. So my message to the younger generation is, don't be discouraged if there's no big confrontation. Don't be discouraged if you can't enjoy the glory of the march and the demonstration and the newspaper coverage. Just be aware that what you are doing is organize, organize, organize.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Peter has a P.S. before Wendell speaks.
Yeah. One thing I think, one criticism I have of the film, not her book, but the film Berkeley in the 60s, is it, and people tend to think this way, the next generation particularly, people tend to say, I wish I'd been there. And I think it's very important to encourage people to do that, not to be there, to feel, I wish I had done that.
Thank you. Wendell.
So I think for me the most important thing about Slate was its ability to hold together liberals and radicals around fundamental American concepts like, you know, freedom and justice and equity. And we dissolved Slate when it became clear that we were no longer able to do that. And I think probably largely under pressure of the war, there was a whole split between liberals and radicals. And as we know, the radicals, us, went off into increasingly isolated and often bizarre areas, feeling that, you know, our strength is as the strength of 10 because our line is pure. And I think for me, one of the lessons is the importance of really trying to organize, the importance of really trying to speak to the people in the middle in language that people can understand, to understand that many fundamental American values actually have enormous radical potential and that we should not disparage that.
Thank you very much. And in the 1960s, I worked in a little county in southern Alabama, and one of the songs that people sang there even at that time was, this may be the last time. May be the last time we walk together, maybe the last time we talk together. So Art is right. There isn't going to be a 100-year anniversary. This may be our last time together, so go give a Slate member a hug. Thanks to our panel. Thanks to all of you for coming.